Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Lisa Green, the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Our moderator for this evening is Tim O'Reilly. Tim O'Reilly is a founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media, thought by many to be the best computer book publisher in the world. Tim is a catalyst for change, identifying and evangelizing the knowledge of alpha geeks and technology trends before they hit the mainstream through his books, speaking engagements, and blog, The O'Reilly Radar. Known for popularizing the terms open source and Web 2.0, Tim is an activist for open standards and sensible intellectual property law. In addition to being a visionary, Tim is an entrepreneur. He created Safari Books Online, the first web-native service for online book content, and O'Reilly Alpha Tech Ventures, which funds disruptors, innovators, and hackers of the status quo. To Tim's left is the first member of our panelists, Jimmy Wales. Jimmy is an American internet entrepreneur, best known for founding Wikipedia.org, as well as many other wiki-related organizations, including the charitable organizations Wikimedia Foundation and the for-profit company Wikia, Inc. He was appointed a fellow of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School in 2005, and in 2006, he joined the board of directors of the nonprofit organization Creative Commons. In 2007, the World Economic Forum recognized Wales as one of the young global leaders. This prestigious award acknowledges the top 250 leaders for their professional accomplishments, their commitment to society, and their potential to contribute to shaping the future of the world. To Jimmy's left, we have Dr. Stephen Friend. Dr. Friend has held faculty positions at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital and a fellowship at the Whitehead Institute. In 1994, he was recruited by Nobel laureate Dr. Leland Hartwell to join the Fred Hutchinson's Cancer Research Center Seattle Project, an advanced institute for drug discovery. While there, Drs. Friends and Hartwell developed a method for examining large patterns of genes, which led them to co-found Rosetta Informatics. In 2001, Rosetta was acquired by Merck, and Stephen joined Merck as the senior vice president in charge of oncology. In March of 2009, Stephen left Merck to found SAGE, a not-for-profit medical research organization designed to revolutionize how researchers approach the complexity of human biological information and the treatment of disease. And finally, we have John Wilbanks. As VP of Science, John Wilbanks runs the Science Commons Project at Creative Commons. He came to Creative Commons from a fellowship at the World Wide Web Consortium in Semantic Web for Life Sciences. Previously, he founded and led to acquisition InSilico, a bioinformatics company that built semantic graph networks for use in pharmaceutical research and development. Previously, John was the assistant director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. And now I'll turn it over to you, Tim.
All right. Thank you very much. The title of this session is Making the Web Work for Science. And I want to be really clear that the topic we want to explore is how to make the web work for science itself, not for existing science publishers, not for existing companies that take advantage of the way science works today. What we're really trying to understand is how do the techniques of the web, how do tools like wikis, the semantic web, all kinds of new technologies help us actually advance the progress of science? Because that's what we care about. I've heard a lot of comments that, this web stuff isn't really working for Nature Publishing Group. They're not making money yet, as if making money is the measure of whether or not it's working, as opposed to how we're actually progressing in our understanding of the world around us. So I was wondering if you guys could take that as your sort of starting point. Maybe, Jimmy, you could start with your thoughts on the the web, wikis, and the progress of science?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think for me, one of the most important things we can do is to really step back and take a little bit of a philosophical perspective of what does it mean to say the web is working for science. And for me, a big part of it is to recognize and really appreciate that in a very large part, science is a conversation. It's a large number of people having a conversation about the facts of reality. And what we see in other aspects of the web is that when we think of conversation, we shouldn't think just in terms of message board posts or emails back and forth, but we can also think of conversation, we can think of Wikipedia as an example of a very large-scale conversation by thousands of people about the world. And it's a conversation that involves sharing knowledge, constructing something, collaborating together, and building a very large edifice, which is exactly what science should be doing. And so one of the questions that I have about all this process is that we have this layer within science of the prestigious journals and the peer review, all of which have traditionally served a very good purpose. But they're also really bound to very old models of thinking, old models of having a conversation. They don't move very quickly. They are very top-down. And we know a lot of aspects of it are actually quite broken. A lot of the peer review process is really very questionable, and there's sort of a lot of poisonous effects of old boys' networks and all kinds of different things that just don't work very well. And we see in many fields of science, we see people just beginning to sort of ignore that and beginning to try to do things outside those parameters. But we're in this transitional stage where the web is beginning to work for science, but as you said, it's not necessarily working for certain traditional institutions, and that's a real puzzle.
Probably true for the web in every industry.
Well, the web hasn't been really
new players, and
the web hasn't been really great for Britannica, for example. But that doesn't mean that we're hurting for basic encyclopedic knowledge
or so. Rand McNally Road Atlas.
Exactly.
Stephen, yeah, maybe you could give us some perspective from where you sit.
So I've two perspectives. One, having trained in biophysics and theoretical biophysics, where I would argue in the physics world, the ability of scientists, physicists to actually take on large data sets and actually use the web and link and get to the data and make insights, get recognition, things like that. I would argue that on the meter, there are some very good examples of where the web is working well to connect those scientists. I go to the other side where I've spent more time recently, last 10 or 15 years, which is on trying to understand human disease, trying to take biology and interface it with the genomic information that's being generated, where in the last decade, the scale and scope of the data that biologists used to work with, which was in terms of hundreds of patients with dozens of markers and sort of did it in a colloquial way, and how they're trying to interface now with what I'd say is terabytes to petabytes of biologic data. And is the web working to connect biologists to this rich stream of information that's coming out from the genome? Really, it's not at all. And I think that there are differences in culture. There are differences at many levels, but the one that I'm I would say is a critical one is many clinician scientist biologists have felt that every time there was an insight to be made, it should be done from scratch on their own, and that the concept of sharing the data, of putting it together, what the web does well in terms of connecting people, connecting data, building off of what one person has done to the other, that's a foreign zone right now. And we can talk about why that is. But it would be hard to posit the web is working well for the clinician scientist trying to link with the genomic information right now.
Right. Okay. So there's a couple of points that you're making. One is to get beyond the idea of the web as web pages and documents and you're talking a lot more about the data and the, particularly the ability to link the data that's produced by various scientists into some kind of coherent edifice.
That's right.
Yeah. We'll come back to this, but I'd love to get your perspectives on whether you think some of the semantic web and linked data initiatives are going to make any headway there. But maybe, John, perhaps you can...
So I heard a funny quote last week. I was at a meeting on the future of the scientific article, and the last quote was this gentleman said, first, there's too much to read, and second, that I can't access enough of it. And I think it sort of captures part of the problem here, which is that the web lets us manage an almost enormous and unthinkable amount of information because of the amount of collective filtering and the technology that we've got available. And science already sort of works that way. It's sort of an inefficient wiki where you make your edits paper by paper instead of edit by edit in a wiki. And so if we're going to think about the web working for science, I think there's sort of two pieces. There's science as content distribution, which is the publication model. And the publisher's profit margins are doing very well. Their Web 2.0 efforts aren't sort of making money, but right now they're double billing everything and doing really well. And then there's sort of science as a discovery engine. And in each of these cases, there's some resistance in the wire to the web scale effects that we sort of take for granted in culture and commerce taking effect. And so the places where it is working are places where people who don't have to deal with the guilds and the resistance in the wire can do that. And synthetic biology is a place where wikis are being widely used and parts are being shared over the net. But in more traditional fields that have traditional reward and tenure promotion systems, there's no incentive to use the web the way we use it culturally, to record sort of daily observations, which are the sort of things that we would share in a blog. So there's still this sort of tendency to treat communication and science as a very stilted, formal thing, as opposed to really a conversation that could take place in a wiki.
Well, one comment, I don't want to name names, but I was struck a few years ago at a meeting I organized by a hallway conversation in which an eminent practitioner of a field was in conversation with a layperson. And this person was asking what he did, and he described it. And they said, oh, that's just like, and again, leave the name out, what some young guy who'd actually been a student of the fellow in question does. But the young guy was web native, web savvy, and was already well known to a lot of people out in the world. And so the guy who, by the old standards of credentialing, was more senior and the guy who should be looked up to, was now described as doing the same kind of work as his formerly junior colleague. And I wonder if you could talk to this sort of idea of the web as a new method of credentialing scientists, which is routing around some of the old, you know, institutional affiliations and ways that people publish.
Stephen, you want to jump in or should
I? Why don't you jump in? I'm thinking.
I've stumped you there.
It's never stopped me. See, they know me. So I think this really, it goes sort of discipline by discipline. The traditional credentialing systems tend to still control the funding and the faculty positions in the institutions that host science. So in the disciplines where science requires iron, money, facilities, the traditional credential system is resistant to that sort of change. But in the newer disciplines, some of these fusion disciplines that cut across sort of traditional engineering and new science, I think you see...
Yeah, this was in one of those categories.
Yeah, the only credit that matters is the credit that's coming out of the more new systems. I mean, these are journals that are web-only. These are journals that are open access by default. And so I think for scientists that are caught on the line between those, it can be a pretty tough spot to be in.
Yeah, we'll see whether that thinking helped. I think we're in a transition phase where for biology, many of the experiments that you'd want to do now require massive amounts of resources, dollars, coordination, sort of a blessing of the group that's saying this needs to be done. And to that extent, that old school hierarchy is still driving a lot of who gets those funds. But the irony, I think, is that for almost all of those examples where you've had to do an experiment in a organized, sanctioned way, and cost a lot of money, required a lot of resources, there should be an ability, if you have a distributed set of scientists, or I would argue, for example, patient advocates, that are interested in doing things that are not necessarily through the hierarchy, to be able to get the work done. And therefore, I think the old style of who's going to be able to get the experiment done may not apply. The best example I have on this one that I think is in action now is in breast cancer. Susan Love, who is one of the advocates, has said that she's going to link 100, a million women together who all are willing to participate in trials, and they'll be available not by an NIH-funded study, not by a pharma-funded study, but available in a web-based access, so that if you want to do something that used to be $100 million to pull off, it could actually be triggered by people working in a more distributed way directly with the people who want to give data, get results back. So I think
isn't that also what consumer-facing personal genomics startups like 23andMe are doing? Effectively, they're charging people for something that's kind of looks like a bit of a kind of, oh, isn't this cool? But they're really building an opt-in database that could be used for research, and that's at least to how they describe their long-term thinking. So it's a kind of citizen participation in building a scientific database.
I like the way you put that in. I actually think it's the network that they're building as much as the science that they're doing right now
right.
that is really pivotal. And once you get that network built, then actually the science that you want to increase in sort of how it can be used, I think will be ready.
Well, another one that's a little bit like that working on the other side of the genotype-phenotype divide is patientslikeme.com, which is a site that in which sufferers of certain diseases get together and they pool their symptoms and the treatment that they're doing, and they basically share notes. So in some sense, it's a post-clinical trial.
That's right. And it gets back to John's point on the guilds that control things. So right now, it's the physicians and large companies that say, this is a good idea or this is what I want to do. I think there's a really nice opportunity. This maybe is the web working. If it's able to migrate, who can actually get what done and therefore have an impact that way?
So enable new players in some sense.
That's right.
Yeah. Like, but there does seem to be a... sort of a rise in the acceptance of these new technologies from the mainstream. I noticed recently there was an announcement of NIH coming to an agreement with the Wikimedia Foundation. Could you talk a little bit about that, Jamie?
Well, I mean, we just we held a Wikipedia Academy in conjunction with the NIH to sort of train people there on how Wikipedia works and how they might be able to contribute and participate to improve the health information. And I think that what's interesting about that is probably 4 or 5 years ago, that would have seemed very, very strange and odd. Now, everybody says, it sort of makes sense. This is the sort of thing that should be happening more and more. And we're actually seeing that's just sort of a recent well-known example, but we're seeing, increasingly museums are collaborating with the Wikipedia community to improve the entries about art. And so we've had several different collaborations in Europe especially. So a lot of these traditional institutions, I think, are beginning to realize that there are new modes of distribution. But boy, I mean, sometimes they're quite thick in the skull to deal with for institutional reasons. So it takes time for change to happen.
Yeah. Well, and so there's a good sort of counterweight to that, which is Pfizerpedia. So there was a computer scientist at Pfizer in the Cambridge offices who installed the Wikimedia software, but he realized thinking the idea was that they would be able to connect internal information to external science information on Wikipedia through the system. And what they found very quickly was that they basically had to disable all inbound, outbound data transfer with the external Wikipedia because of IP concerns. And that sort of starved it of what he thought it was going to do. But what it turned into was basically this, it was everything every external data integration company had ever promised. It became the internal linking system for all of the files across Pfizer. And now it has like 14,000 registered daily users. And it's become sort of the default knowledge management system of the organization in a pretty significant context. And that's after hundreds of millions of dollars of data integration efforts commissioned by Pfizer from people like IBM. So the web is routing around damage in science in its own way.
Well, that's a really good observation. I think of the parallels with open source software. You know, people on the outside have always been focused on, for example, Microsoft as sort of the antithesis of open source. And yet if you talk to people within Microsoft, turns out that many of their projects actually develop in a way that inside the Microsoft firewall look a lot like an open source project. As a very common example, the ASP.NET software there sort of was originally a volunteer project of a couple of guys, and it just spread organically inside the company until one day Bill Gates heard about it and said, come show me your project, and then it became anointed as the formal project. And I think that kind of informality becoming formalized is something that the web teaches us.
Well, and this goes to something that Jimmy talked about earlier in the prep room, which is that the value of the Pfizerpedia over time will be its ability to connect through the standard technology to the external Wikipedia as it gets more powerful. And so there's going to hit a certain point at which it makes more sense to have their internal stuff at some point interoperate with the external world to get the benefit of what the external world is collaboratively building.
Yeah. I have to say one thing that I think we should acknowledge is sad, whether it has to be or not. And it was the reference to the power that actually that system has, but in a company such as a pharmaceutical company, which is working on both disease biology and making drugs, the sadness is that actually the disease biology part of it, I would argue, should be in the public domain. So to say that a company needs to somehow come up with a profit for making something that is proprietary, that is their way of developing a treatment, you can argue right or wrong. The one that I think is very hard to argue is right is companies feeling as if proprietary knowledge on the biology is something that actually should be within set walls, because
as opposed to proprietary knowledge on their products
or on sort of how you're going to end up doing the treatment. And the reason I say that is that almost all the biology that's done today is sadly done in these proprietary fiefdoms, often within universities, I'm sorry to say. There's also IP issues that sit there. And the data that's coming out and the ability to actually have a distributed network that could really help in biology today, I'd argue, has issues on standardization. There are a lot of problems. But one of the big ones is that disease biology is still considered to be a competitive area. And until that becomes a pre-competitive space, I think it's just sad for the patients that can't be done.
Yeah. So this just brings to mind something. For me, this is it's sort of like what you're describing to me sounds a little bit like the era of software before people really got how open source could work. And what's interesting is it's sort of amazing how much amazing open source software is built, and very often, in large part, built by programmers who are being paid to build it by companies who choose to share it, because overall they've come to understand there's more value in the sharing than in the making the proprietary. And so this, I think, for me, this is a good point to say a little bit of a pitch for Science Commons, because I think a big part of what Science Commons is trying to do is figure out how to create the ground conditions, whether through licensing protocols, standards, that make it actually possible for people to begin to break out of those silos, and to do it in a way that, I mean, what's sad about it is, if you believe as I do, it's like that not because it actually is profitable for them to keep it locked up, but because they just don't know that it might not be, and they just don't know what to do or how to do it beyond that.
Well, and a lot of it is there's a force of habit. I mean, this is something, if you think about what the web did to business models, right? Then one of the hardest things about adopting a web business model was your existing business model. And we've got a pretty robust system of business models in science based on property. And we have precious few ways to track contributions to science other than property, either claiming it through a copyrighted article, claiming it through a patent. We don't have a lot of those sort of less formal, less legal systems that we have in blogs and wikis. So there's no, you know, there's no legal requirement for bloggers to track each other back. But they do that because it's easy to do the right thing technically. And too much of science is sort of treating it on making it hard to do the wrong thing through the law. And so trying to rewire that takes a lot of people. We're a piece of a big project here. And part of what we hope is that through conversations like this and through efforts like Stephen's and through the sorts of things that Jimmy is doing at Wikipedia, that we can actually get a bootable system up, because we think it's going to take something that works better than the existing system for scientists to join in on. Because as it is now, there's not a lot of reasons to opt out of the traditional reward system.
So when you talk about rewards, that leads very much to the whole question of how science is funded. And I heard a fairly sobering story this past weekend from a physician doing research on statins. She said she was the only person she knew of in her field who was not funded by a drug company. And she also said that every study that was published reflected the views of the funder. If it did not, she talked about something like 40 studies that she'd looked at, and she said 20 of them were positive, reflecting the, you know, the goals of the drug company funding the study. Nine of them that did not reflect the goals of the funder were not just not published at all, and 11 that did not reflect the results that were sought were written up as if they were positive for the drug company. So I guess the question, one of the things that brings to mind is a lot of people, you know, in the beginning were asking the question whether wikis were reliable or, oh my gosh, you know, it's edited by anyone. And yet it's completely transparent because you can see who made the edits, you can watch the process, you actually have real peer review in a way that it seems that we no longer have in science in quite the same way. Can you guys talk about the process of peer review and how the web can make it better?
I think your example is a pretty potent one of where it could have a benefit. I think independent of the issues on the funding, I think we're real and are there. There's a very important one, which I think we've gotten numb to. We just don't even recognize we do in terms of as scientists and how what gets published. And this is this issue of what's a positive and what's a negative study. And the concept that you should only consider as valuable something that worked in the sense of a traditional sense, right, was as expected.
Yeah.
And I do think that if there are editors in those guilds that have only so much space, then there are certain reasons that they can say they must limit that to the most critically important, new, odd thing that gets put in. But that doesn't have to happen.
On the web.
The web. Right. And I would say that one of the most valuable things to scientists is to go back and look at those times when it all didn't work and what was shown not to be true. If for nothing, there are 2 points here. One is that if for nothing else, then someone invariably is repeating that again and again, thinking it's going to work. So it's so wasteful not have access to that which is not going to work. And the other part that I think is part of the concept of connectivity and what you do with data is that every time someone goes to publish a paper, they basically have to start from scratch, take the conclusions that are out there, but the experiment itself has to be done by them solely. And they have to recapitulate something that actually was often done reasonably well by another. So in software, when you start from the beginning, you don't have to start, when you do something, you don't start from the beginning. You go and you leverage what people have done before. And I think this concept of actually getting data to the point where it adds together, and you could actually take data that someone else had generated and put it with the data that you were generating, also enables a distributed contributor network that works in a very different way. So I think the 2 points are, one is data that didn't work is valuable, and the other is why is there such a compulsion, particularly in biology, to reconstruct the entire experiment and saying, I did this, but I added this new element, favoring it that way?
Yeah, so when you talk about building a shared edifice of data, that's not just a big heap of data. It has some structure. You know, it's one of the things that people, I think, forget about something like Wikipedia or the web as a whole, is there are a few simple rules that give it structure. What do we need to think about when we start thinking about the data of shared science and how to structure it?
Well, I want to briefly start that answer, but I've got to turn it to John, because I think they, at Science Commons, have spent more time thinking of the aspects beyond the quality of the data. But one of the things I want to say is that people generally don't do an experiment with a concept that someone's actually going to use that data later. So the concepts of annotation and quality that are essential for using someone else's work are basically rarely in supplementary materials. They say what you did, but the quality component and standardized annotation, particularly on clinical studies where things get called in different countries in different ways, the standardization and the quality on the science side, I think, prevent that from happening. But I think there are many other aspects of sharing and governance rules that maybe you want to mention.
Sure, and I'm going to say a few things, then I'm going to actually throw to Jimmy, because I think that there's some technical aspects to this, which we've looked at, but there's the social aspects of how a community interacts with itself that I think we can learn from Wikipedia on. So I think the first thing that I typically try to push back on in the data sharing context is names, which is that we're sort of used to having domain names work for the web. And so when you go to, you know, O'Reilly.com, you know what you're going to get. When you go to Radar Networks, you know what you're going to get. And in the sciences, you need to have these unique names for the entities that are in the described in the data itself, so that when, you know, five of us each talk about a given gene, that we use the same URL to describe it. We might disagree on lots of other things about it, but if we can agree on the same URL that's semantically empty, then we can start to link assertions made about that gene or that URL. And getting to a DNS for the sciences is going to require a lot more work than doing the DNS for the internet, because it involves scientists who don't like to agree about things. If we had five biologists and we asked them all what a peptide was, we'd get five different answers. And so agreeing on URLs for peptides is contentious. It's political, not technical. And so it's likely that the only way you'll get agreement on names is to have something that works well enough that people are willing to swallow their pride and adopt the names to get the functionality.
So is it really, maybe I'm missing something here, but if I think about successful databases that are affecting all of our lives in the Web 2.0 world, they often have a unique and human recognizable namespace that we don't actually have to have pre-existing agreement on. So, for example, MapQuest and Google Maps and Yahoo Maps and Microsoft Maps, they can either use lat long or they can use street addresses, and humans can kind of guess the street addresses, and it all kind of works because there's a unique signature. Now, when you talk about gene sequences, isn't there also something similar that here's actually a common sequence that you can hang all kinds of other data off of, or
yeah,
chemical
and,
compound?
And even easier, you can proxy, because those sequences are stored at the U.S. government NCBI database with a unique database identifier. The problem is they change their URL schemas all the time.
Okay.
So if you try to link into the URL schemas, you wind up getting broken code on a regular basis. So one of the things that we've had to do is to create a stable namespace that includes that identifier.
Okay.
Eventually, when they decide to provide semantic web namespaces, we can retire ours. But until database providers stop changing their URL schemas on the fly whenever they do a rebuild, it's very hard to build stable systems that use the URLs as identifiers.
And on the clinical symptom or signs, beyond just gene names, if you get to trying to link what's going on in patients, take a word like fatigue. Take a word like emphysema, and it means so much different that you can't do that linkage. So I think it is at the genomic molecular level, but it becomes really absurdly different usages when you get to tie that through to traits and what
and
people.
So how do you deal with that at Wikipedia, with this ambiguation, and what's the social process?
Well, That's a huge question. It's just funny. I was just thinking about, to this day, I think one of the reasons TVGuide.com didn't become successful like IMDb is that I remember two or three times back in, must have been 96 or 97, they changed all their URLs and left 404 pages everywhere. And I was among a large number of people who said, I'm never linking to these idiots again. So somebody should tell them to stop doing that. That's a bad idea. So I think what I would say about a lot of these naming things is not so much, I think it's, Tim hinted at an answer, it's often a few very simple rules which allow for a conversation and allow for a structure to emerge. One of the worst ways to try to solve this kind of problem, which is the one that intuitively people often reach for first, is let's convene a very important government panel and hire 100 staffers and come up with the taxonomy of the world, right? This does not work. It will never work. And at the same time, we don't have to sort of give ourselves over to complete anarchy either, right? We can say there are certain protocols, certain procedures, and there can be some contention around the namespace, but people will tend to converge over time on namespaces that are useful as long as there are standard methods and protocols to talk about those things. Like, for example, latitude and longitude and addresses, which are done slightly different in different places, but it sort of works well enough, and you can actually figure out more or less how to get things done.
Well, so the gene IDs will live in one place and the protein IDs live in another space. And so the stuff that lives at the U.S. government is relatively stable because they're going to be funded. But, you know, every 5 years or so, the funding cycles change and a database provider loses their funding. And so, you know, we have to work on things like living wills for the database so that it can be copied and then replicated in a second place if the database fails at the original location.
Well, yeah, I mean, to the extent we have open licensing so that other people can take the databases, they don't have to. I mean, Wikipedia doesn't depend. The survival of the data and the information that everybody's been working on for the last 8 years in Wikipedia does not depend on the survival of the Wikimedia Foundation. Mm-hmm. If it went out of business and Wikipedia went down, there's tons of copies of the database out there, and they're all under a free license, so something would happen, right? Mm-hmm. That data will never be erased from the planet.
So I think the importance of the commons is a
the importance
a theme
of the commons
here.
Is a real, I mean, it's really core. Because you can't, and there's lots of reasons why people should be very cautious about adopting a database schema that may depend on the survival of one entity, because then when that entity goes down and things are broken, what a huge mess, you know.
Well, but that gets into sort of the reality of the data world, right? I mean, in molecular biology alone, the sort of the yearly list is almost up to, it's like 995 different databases, and the vast majority of them are, you know, they're long-tail databases, right? They're they're sort of curated artisanally by one or two graduate students, and they depend on the largesse of the PI staying in business. And it's really, you know...
The PI being the principal investigator.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So what about machine learning? You know, I was struck recently by this a project called the Flickr Astrometry Project, and what they're doing is they're doing machine learning to look at millions and millions of amateur astronomy photographs, and regardless of orientation, they're able to pick out what part of the sky it is and then map it onto a sky atlas. So in this case, they're not asking people to, you know, the individuals to tag their photographs. They're actually having a machine go look at it, say, oh, I recognize what part of the sky that is, and then add the sky survey tags with the machine. Now, I know there's a lot more bots trolling Wikipedia and adding structure to it. Are we going to be seeing this structure decided beforehand, or are we going to be able to start to apply it after the fact?
So... just real quick, so astronomy is one of my favorite examples of the web working for science. There's an international virtual observatory system that's doing everything that I'm praying for biology to do, essentially already without government intervention. It's awesome. And when it comes to the machine learning part, I tend to think that there's going to be an iterative cycle where the machines add structure and humans look at the results of that and add validity and credential to the and then the machines will sort of cycle back and again on it. There's just too much for people to do it alone in a sensor and a robot sort of data gathering world. But Stephen's actually doing this, so he should probably say more.
I think astronomy is a good example. Another example that may be known is in protein folding and looking at how you could put structures together. I like that example because protein folding is about as complicated as you get. And it is always thought that only the guild of experts could possibly make insights. But for those who have been involved in these distributed projects.
Like folding at home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And folding at home has someone who has no background in the, quote, needed skills to be able to do that. And I actually think we are overestimating the role of experts in biology, whether it's in what is a pathologic a diagnosis, what it looks like, how to make insights. And I think we're, you know, one transition, a tipping point away from someone taking a project on, which you would say could never be done because it needed the expert of this oncologist or this pathologist or this expert, to show people that actually, again, it's because of past guilds and rules of who should be able to do what that actually has kept that from being more distributed. So I look forward to that.
Just push this machine learning question a little further. I was this last weekend in this very wonderful class put on by John Brockman of the EDGE Foundation with Craig Venter and George Church. The conversation came up about actually reading the human genome and the fact that no human has actually read that. Computers have read it. And, you know, the question is, how much are our machines now part of that scientific process? And effectively, we are talking about rules for our machines to work, and not just for us to work together.
I like your description. I think it's spot on in that in the understanding of the variations that we all have that comes in, you know, 3 billion unit packets, our genome, the machine is by far the superior. It's such a striking superiority, it's not even questionable. How could a person keep track of that? What's awkward is that we still tell our descriptions of disease in a narrative way, not used to being able to embrace the complexity that really is represented at the molecular level. So the machine is actually reading it in a powerful way, but our own descriptions of what is a disease stay back on a, this single gene does this, this single gene does that. Our diagnostics, our therapies are sitting there. But if you were to ask anyone who had sort of come from Mars and looked at it, it would be that we need to have molecular models that actually are probabilistic causal models of disease that are the a much more appropriate way to look at the complexity.
Right. So
and
I guess
reduce
the,
it to the past.
Yeah, the point I'm getting at here is it sounds like in so many scientific disciplines, we're getting so much data that it's going to be machines that are reading it for us. And the fact is, machines have shown us that they're very good at working together.
Well, and you see this there's a guy down the hall at MIT who spent a lot of time programming, basically writing a specific language to deal with emergent negotiations between sensors. Mm-hmm. Right, it's a completely different programming language that he's written to deal with sort of, you know, environmental sensor networks so they can self-identify and negotiate meaning locally at a very small level. Like, what does temperature mean when they're measuring in water? And I think it'll be something like that that works in systems where we can control the information space a little better, like environmental data. In the life sciences, it's hard because we're studying an evolved system that we keep trying to make appear like it's a design system. And the thing my programmers keep talking about is that the right metaphor is moving from assembly language to higher level language. And it took 20 years for Fortran to really to take over from the machine languages. And we're moving from people compilers to machine compilers of that information. But at every step, it's an evolved system that keeps tricking us into thinking it's a design system because it's this massively complicated thing. And the machines are really dumb, so we have to teach them everything about it. And so I tend to think that the machine learning is going to work better and much more immediately in astronomy and observational sciences than it will work in biology and climate change, because those systems are so much more massively unpredictable and evolved. And the danger is sort of overfitting in the short term. And then what I'm hoping is that someone comes up with a breakthrough technology or interface system in one of those fields where the machine learning really is effective, and then we can bring that over to bear.
So coming back around to citizen science, do you see any particularly productive areas where we can be recruiting people in the way that the web has shown us so effectively it can do, you know, into actually helping out with the process of science?
One example that I think is poised to happen is and it's a variation of what is going on with patients like me, 23andMe, is where individuals with a rare disease band together and say, we're all able to contribute our knowledge to a specific disease. And we're willing to contribute not only our clinical information, what it feels like, what we're doing in a daily basis, at a level of contribution that can't possibly be what sits in a physician's office, because it's real time. I'm going to take an example like Alzheimer's or Lou Gehrig's disease or something like that, and the patients say, I'm going to track all of these things, and I'm going to put it into a database where how I'm feeling, and I'm willing to stick my finger into the following machine and give this sample because I want to know what's going on. So I think it is likely to come from advocacy groups that say, we care too much about this, and people aren't tracking us, and we'll track ourselves. And so I think it's clinical information, but I also think it will get to the level of providing samples, getting genomic information that will... that will be one of those tipping examples where then people go, well, if they did it, we should do it, and we should do it, and we should do it. But I think that's within the next 3 years.
It's interesting. I've just seen an example of this in a very informal way. There's a pet diabetes wiki, and I was showing somebody, they said they couldn't believe there was such a thing, but there's a community of people whose pets have diabetes, and I thought they were just there sort of sharing stories and... No, they're actually sharing very detailed data on drug doses and glucose levels as they measure it for their cat or dog or what have you. They don't have tools to do that in a really effective way. They're just sharing graphs and information. But they are motivated to put that information there, and they would love, I think, to have that go back to science in some useful way. So it's very interesting.
Well, so the democratization of tools, I think, is going to drive the citizen science that we get. So one place where we're seeing some movement is the idea that a community of sort of normal citizens can come together to mark up a Wikipedia entry on a disease or a topic space. Say you have a bunch of college students who have access to all of the articles that a given university does. They can basically take that and extract the facts from that knowledge corpus and put it into something like Wikipedia, citing the original article, and create something that's essentially a summary of the field that would have previously been an expensive review paper. So that's sort of one way to go. But then the more extreme version, I think it's called the Human Microbiome Project, and there's sort of a corollary, and it goes around sort of cheap microbial sequencing, which is it's coming out of the church lab. And the idea is that you get a bunch of people together to sample their own microbial profiles, or to even go out and take swabs of all of the public surfaces at an intersection and do a geolocation of all of the microbes that are on all of the buttons for the crosswalks.
Is it microbiome.org, I think?
I think it is. Yeah, it's Jason Bowie that talked about it. I mean, that's sort of really pushing the envelope that shows what can happen when the tools are democratized and cheap.
All right, thanks. I think we're going to move on to the next phase.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California and that you are listening to Making the Web Work for Science with Tim O'Reilly, Stephen Friend, Jimmy Wales, and John Wilbanks. Our thanks to Tim O'Reilly, Stephen Friend, Jimmy Wales, and John Wilbanks for their comments here today. And now we will have a question and answer period with audience questions moderated by Tim O'Reilly. Tim, if there are questions, please raise your hand. And Tim, if you'd like to select people, I'll run the microphone around.
All right. All right, over here.
Sure. what is it about biology and medicine that makes it seem to be so much more challenging for the web to work for science than, say, chemistry, particle physics, astronomy, all the other disciplines, you know, mathematics, all the other disciplines? It seems like pharma and biology seem much more challenging.
I think there's a pretty easy answer, and it's money.
Money? Absolutely. And so that would be money, money, money. But I think even when there's a will to do it, it is that medicine has been something that is still practiced as the concept of the revered priest who has a insight that should be noted in a personal way. It's the priestly nature of medicine, as opposed to that we all share that information. And the way those personal recollections, the ways of linking that at that level, are almost embraced when they're done in an individualistic way that actually defies the ability of actually sharing that data.
And it's also, it's really, the other aspect of money, money, money is that it's really expensive to find a drug. And that's a reality that we can't avoid. And so at a certain level, this is where I think Stephen's distinction of the biology should be pre-competitive and the chemistry that acts on that biology is the place where we can have protection. Because it's the chemistry that we sell as drugs to people. And so until we can find a way to radically reduce the cost of drug discovery, we're going to live with the reality of a patent culture around the products. But if we can make that change happen by making the biology pre-competitive, then that's one of the only sort of non-miraculous approaches open to us.
Question over here.
My name's Peter Gisello. Two questions. I'm at the bottom of the totem pole working at Kaiser, and Dr. Friend, one of the things that they're investing in like $1 billion, is this computer network with all the medical charts and eventually all the data on every patient in Kaiser. And one of the things they talk about more in, I think, rhetoric, but they actually have, they say 500,000 examples, is scientific study work. And I was just curious about if you're in contact with them or taken into consideration about their structure and their goals and objectives and how that would interface with SAGE. And my second question for Mr. Wales would be, I'm also a military veteran and I've been interested in citizen service, community service, military service, but one of the big problems is getting people in various disciplines to look at that as a catalyst and how that implicates their areas of expertise. And it seems to me that like the Wikipedia structure is the ideal way to motivate people to look at it from their perspective and then look at the more comprehensive impact that could provide. But my struggle is seeing it happen.
I'll take the first question, which I'm going to broaden a little bit. There are 1,000 or more projects that are going on all over the world of collecting data on patients, collecting specimens, with a concept that that actually is going to be able to lead to knowledge of the disease. One of the harsh realities is that very few of those studies have the following three components, which are essential to actually sharing things in an important way. One is genomic information on the same patient, that there's actually some element of what we call an intermediate trait and outcomes. So usually they're samples that could build up these big biospecimen things, that containers or repositories that sit out there. But rarely, because of privacy issue, because of IP, other issues, is there an accessibility to outcomes data, intermediate traits, and genomic information. And I would argue that there's less than 100 of those coherent global genomic packets that are out there to be shared on the web. So that has to be the direction that companies who are and foundations and government efforts are being driven towards, as opposed to the other 900 plus.
But don't you think that's going to be changing pretty fast as the benefits of personal genomics and personalized medicine become mainstream?
I'd like to think so. So far, it's been disjointed. So there is some amazing genomic information that's out there that's not connected to outcomes data. And there are a lot of beautiful outcome studies that are sitting there that were not where those individuals actually got that. So I think that will change. And then to finish up, what I think has to happen is actually sharing the data without having a model on which to reflect it never worked for physics, never worked for chemistry, to do it without having models. And I do think we're going to have ability to reflect that data onto models and be sharing the models, not just the data.
Right. On the personalized medicine, I just want to make a small clarification. One of the really simple ways of explaining that for our audience, and correct me if I'm getting anything wrong here, but a lot of what we're discovering is that we used to have a study that would say, oh, this drug is, 60% effective. And now with personalized medicine, what we really understand is that it's actually 100% effective for 60% of the population, which is a very, very different phenomenon, and that's why it's so important to get the genomic data together with the outcome data.
Absolutely.
Because all of a sudden, when you put the two together, you understand that actually it makes no sense whatsoever to give this $100,000 course of treatment to this person because they don't have the gene that makes it work.
So on the second question, I'm sorry, but I wasn't quite sure what the question was.
Well, the question is like you were saying earlier, money. Wikipedia is a very broad structure. Are there examples of, like the diabetes Wikipedia, it's a very narrow one, but we're dealing with certain global warming issues, a whole variety of issues, and we need to look at strategies that affect 10 different problems at the same time, but nobody's willing to separate themselves and compromise on various strategies. And Wikipedia seems to be that simple structure where the opportunity of that compromise could occur after people realize that there's a win-win-win-win if we go on this strategy and I have to swallow some of my resistance to it. But it's just getting the funding and the structure to produce something.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this the only simple thing I can say is that to get people to participate in something, it needs to be easy and simple for them to do so, and they need to have a good reason to do so. And so for a lot of things, when we think about scientists sharing data, say, cross-disciplinary issues like global warming or very specific, very narrow issues, it's two things. One, they have to have some incentive or reason to think that it's worthwhile to do, but also it needs to be easy for them to do. And that's kind of the two main challenges, I guess.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one more question.
So when you folks talk tonight, I hear the government being talked about, the NIH, and kind of the vestigial consequences of requiring the science and studies to be done from the bottom up over and over. When you go home at night and you're passionate about this issue and you want change, do you wish for the government just benign neglect, or do you actually see public policy and legislation to help make these visions happen positively, I guess is the question.
So for me, I have a pretty strong stance here, which is applies across many, many parts of not just the sciences but also culture. I think it's a bit ridiculous that we, as taxpayers, we end up paying for things twice, once in taxes, and then it goes to fund a grant to create something which we then pay for again. So I'm a very strong proponent of the concept that if you're accepting taxpayer money, the results of your work need to be freely available to the taxpayers. And that was never particularly all that important in the old days when the only people who could make use of certain data would be a very narrow guild of people anyway, and they all had access just fine through institutions. Nowadays, particularly with cross-disciplinary things and who knows what, there's a huge set of reasons why lots of scientific results, lots of cultural things should just be out there. And,
I think just
that's my position.
A companion piece to that has to do with a sense that we can't look to the government to do some aspects. So the example I'm going to give is that there are 3% of every patient who gets a drug, for example, in and it's probably lower in with statins, but in oncology, 3% of those patients actually are tracked as to who is responding or not. 3%. 97% of patients who get a chemotherapy, nobody is tracking, did that work or did that not work? Why? Because most of the pharma companies go, hey, if someone's going to buy it, they're going to pay for it. That's good. Not interested necessarily in who is or is not responding. And I strongly feel that actually individuals, advocates, are going to have to step up in most disease areas and say, hey, we can track this. And whether it gets tracked onto Wikipedia, where it gets tracked, I go to bed at night going, how is it? Because if you talk to the individual patients, they'll do anything, right? When you have a family member or someone has a serious disease, there's no lack of passion, but how many people are actually plugging that data? This particular patient did not work. What can we learn from that? And so that's what keeps me up, is those lost opportunities that I don't think the government is going to should and probably won't step up to do.
So, and I'll just echo Jimmy, which is that the government buys most of the science in this country, the academic science, and we need to exercise our market power as a government to make sure that the results are available to the taxpayer. And the second role the government has is to fund infrastructure. The government's good at making things like highways that otherwise they create an enormous amount of public value by being public goods. And so the government can fund an enormous amount of infrastructure for transmitting the results of science that are made legally available through the default rules it sets as a purchaser in the marketplace. And so when I think about the government role here, it's assert the power the government has as a purchaser in the marketplace on behalf of the taxpayers and provide the infrastructure on which we can do innovative private work. Because that's how the systems have really taken off in the web. I mean, everything I'm saying here is based on research we did by looking at how the web scaled. And those are sort of the two roles the government played, and we'd like to see that recapitulated.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Our thanks to Tim O'Reilly, Jimmy Wales, Stephen Friend, and John Wilbanks. And we also thank our audience here and those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 106 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.